Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Maya Norfleet, in for Elaine Cha. School shootings have become an unfortunate part of life in America. So far this year, there were at least 178 incidents of gunfire on school grounds across the country. That's according to Every Town for Gun Safety Fund. Here in St. Louis, students, teachers, and loved ones recently observed the second anniversary of the shooting that took two lives at Central Visual and Performing Arts High School. And while statistics show that most Americans will not experience a school shooting, the threat of violence in what should be a safe space for students and teachers is enough to create anxiety for young people and their families. So how should we as adults support youth in this stage of life with threats of violence looming over their heads? Here to discuss that is Bart Andrews, Chief Clinical Officer at Behavioral Health Response. Bart, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there's numerous studies on how school shootings can impact the performance of a student throughout the rest of their education, even down to how much that student might earn as an adult in their professional career. But before even looking too far into the future for that young person, what are some immediate changes seen in youth after experiencing such a heavy trauma like a school shooting?
So one of the things that we talk about when someone experiences a significant traumatic event like a school shooting is that, one, responses vary. Every kid can look a little bit different. We should expect to see them having a little more fear, a little more anxiety, feeling unsafe at school, right? We might expect to see some sleep disturbance. Mm-hmm. This natural reaction is a part of the way that we process dangerous situations. In fact, many of the things that I'm talking about are healthy responses if you continue to be in a dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. The problem is when the danger has passed and you're still hypervigilant, you're still not sleeping well, you're still looking around you and extra nervous about things, right? Mm-hmm. Another common experience that youth can have is they can keep re-experiencing the event, right? So seeing it again in their head again and again and again. Right. These are things that are not uncommon responses to trauma, but we want to really clarify. It's not a disorder of any kind unless it goes on for a certain length of time, right? If those symptoms come and go very quickly, that's a natural response. Mm-hmm. The longer those symptoms linger, the longer they last, the longer they're impacting that child, the more likely we're talking about something like traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder.
About how long would that be then before a healthy response to trauma turns into a disorder?
It's a really good question. I would expect for somebody that's having a non-disordered response, something that's not going to, something that is doesn't require treatment, less than a month. Once things start going on longer than a month, okay, then that's something we really should be taking a look at, right? If a month after the event, the child still doesn't want to return to school, their sleep's disturbed, they're having nightmares, they're having intrusive thoughts about the event, that's the time I would say, hey, we should go ahead and talk to somebody and see what's going on. And most people will still resolve itself, right? Mm. After 6 months, that's a real clear indication that we've got something that's looking like post-traumatic stress disorder.
I remember the first major school shooting when I was a kid. It was Columbine High School in 1999. And I would have been like 10, around getting close to 10 years old then. And I remember even thinking as a 10-year-old kid, like, could this ever happen in St. Louis, because this happened in my community, in my neighborhood, in my own school. And we fast forward today, and unfortunately, school shootings are happening on nearly a daily basis across the country. What happens to the mental well-being of young people, even if they're not directly involved in school shooting, but just witnessing school shootings so regularly?
This is a really important question because one school shooting is too many. Let's make that really
right.
Clear. We don't want any school shootings. At the same time, the chances, the statistical odds of a child being involved in a school shooting are astronomically low. But here's what happens. Even though those odds are really low, we broadcast it on TV. It's on every TV station. It's on cable. It's on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. So we have something called the availability heuristic. kids think that these events are going to be a lot more likely than they actually are. So here's what happens in that event. And this is why I think school shootings are incredibly, incredibly harmful and damaging to our psyche. These incredibly horrific acts not only hurt the people that are immediately damaged by it, but they damage our trust in the world. They damage their safety net for our children, mm-hmm. right? And so it is much harder to feel safe at school when there is a non-zero chance that you could have a school shooting, no matter how low that is. And talking to my daughter about this, describing what it's been like for her growing up in the era of school shootings, right. Something that I never had to worry about as a kid going to school was that somebody's going to come in and shoot up the school, mm-hmm. right? That's a new type of fear that we didn't have before, right? Yeah. And so these are things we need to acknowledge. Both things are real at the same time. The statistical odds of this happening to you or someone you care about are so incredibly low, lower than being struck by lightning, actually. Mm. At the same time, this is a real thing that does happen. It's something we need to be prepared for and know that it's going to happen. It's going to happen again.
St. Louis recently had a rash of threats targeted at several area schools. And just last week marked the second anniversary of the fatal school shooting at Central Visual and Performing Arts High School. And I find myself thinking about the youngest students at that time would be juniors in high school now, and the graduates from that year are entering their 20s. How does a trauma stemming from violence, or even the threat of violence, impact young people in those stages of life?
So these developmental periods that youth are going through are incredibly important. And so when you think about someone who is a freshman in high school when this traumatic event happens, mm-hmm. it changes in many ways the entire experience of being at high school, right?
Yeah.
So there's some things that we talk about this that are really important. It's really important that one of the messages that we send to people who've been through this is that, yes, this was horrible. Yes, you went through this. But we do not want to make this bigger in your life than it needs to be. Mm. Do not let this event be how you identify with your high school experience or your school experience or the friends that you knew and loved, right? Mm-hmm. So this is something we talk about a lot in therapy and in general mental health wellness education, is that we can make things in our lives much bigger than they need to be, mm-hmm. right? And then they can take up a lot of space and harm us in ways that if we had put it in a different perspective would not be as damaging. Now, I want to say this delicately. Look, when you've been through a traumatic event like this, it is an incredibly big deal, and it's going to leave a mark. But it's also important that we don't define our whole lives and our whole high school experience based on this traumatic event. That's going to lead to more problems than recognizing this was a horrible event. But also, there were good things that happened in school. I had friends. I learned. There were other things that occurred in this developmental process. So a really big thing that we need to do as adults is that we need to emphasize that this was bad, it was real. We need to validate those experiences, but we also need to say that's not all that your school was about. That's not all your early adolescence or late adolescence was about. There was more things going on. And we need to put these events in their appropriate place.
Are there any like tips or ways that you would recommend adults with young people in their life on how to both validate that experience that the young person has gone through, or even if they technically haven't even gone through it, right? They just seen that a school shooting could happen and that can be worrisome enough. How does the adults in those young people's life balance validating those fears and concerns, but also reminding them that, hey, this is a big thing, but it's not your entire experience or your entire life?
It's a wonderful question. And it's good that we're talking about adults, because what the research tells us about childhood trauma and the impact of childhood trauma, a lot of it depends on how the adults in their life responds. And this is why when we're working with parents, we say, even though you've been impacted by this and even though this hurts, it's important that you model resilience to your children, that you model healthy coping strategies. And this is really hard, because when our kids are threatened like this in school, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. our natural response is to be incredibly anxious and to defend and to get in and do things. That's very understandable, and that's also a natural response. So we need to put these things in perspective. So to your point, you put this really well already. Two things exist at the same time. This horrible event happened. We need to acknowledge this horrible event happened. We do acknowledge that you're going to have some intense feelings and some negative experience connected to this thing, because that's natural. Mm. At the same time, we need to model healthy coping strategies, model that you will get through this. Here's how we're going to get through this. And what we don't want to do is identify ourselves as trauma victims for the rest of our lives. In fact, there's really good research that shows this is absolutely fascinating. The objective rating of the trauma is not as predictive of the symptomology a person might experience as much as their rating, their self-rating, their subjective rating of the trauma. So two people can experience the exact same trauma objectively. And the person that rates that trauma as, yes, it was bad, but it's not everything, and I don't want to make it more than it is healthier than the person that magnifies that trauma, catastrophizes that trauma, and that trauma becomes a part of their identity. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're seeing this increasingly with our youth as a diagnosed mental illness, either self-diagnosed, which is really bad out there, please don't do it, or a real diagnosis by a professional is becoming a huge part of their identity. This isn't healthy. This is not what diagnoses are for. And so we need to put these things in perspective, demonstrate healthy coping strategies while validating the emotional experience is very real.
So it's almost like the adult also has to, I'm also trying to put it delicately, but the best way in my head right now is the adults have to get their stuff together before they can even help the child out.
This is really important. We have to have boundaries with our children, right? Adult parental boundaries are really, really powerful. And if you are having an emotional reaction to an event and you are sharing your emotional reaction to that event with a child who is not your therapist, who is not your parent, that's a boundary violation in a way. In fact, you as a parent can emote, and we certainly can demonstrate and have emotional experiences. But how we do that really needs to be thought through and deliberate, and making sure that we're not exposing our children to our own challenges in a way that can make things harder for them.
I'm speaking with Bart Andrews, Chief Clinical Officer at Behavioral Health Response in St. Louis. How does treating trauma differ between youth and adults?
That's a really good question. And the idea that we can take the exact same therapy and use it the exact same way with an adult as we would with a child, there are some challenges to that. But there are some things that work well with adults and children at the same time. The older the child is, for instance, the farther they're in adolescence, the more things like cognitive processing therapy and verbal therapies can really work, right? Mm-hmm. The younger that the child happens to be, there's some things we need to be aware of. For instance, if a child is having a hard time articulating how they're feeling, if they're acting out their trauma, so often what we will see, instead of a child saying, well, I'm anxious all the time, they may be more aggressive, they may be more verbally hostile, they may be more irritable. So that also means when we're doing child therapy, one of the folks that needs to be included in that therapeutic process is the parents. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that we're doing in child therapy is helping the parent become a moderator of the child's environment and helping them reinforce healthy coping strategies. So we have to adjust our approach for therapy based on the child's, not just their age, but their developmental level. For instance, young ladies tend to be much more verbal than young boys. So a talk therapy, a cognitive behavioral, cognitive processing approach might work better with a young lady of the same age. A young man might not respond to that as well. And we might have to do more behavioral activation therapies and focus more on behavior than talk therapy.
So one of the things that I've noticed, or maybe I don't want to accept, might be the better way to say, is that school shootings seem to have been kind of accepted in today's society. We see it in pop culture when it's written into plots for TV and film. And kids today experience active shooter drills on a regular basis, along with the natural disaster drills like tornadoes and earthquakes. What does normalizing school shootings do to young people and to society overall?
There's a lot of layers to this. I think that we need to be very careful in terms of not normalizing in the sense that this is likely to happen. You should not, if you're living in fear every day of a school shooting, we need to have a conversation, because that is not healthy. That is no way for anybody to live their life. And that's going to have a much bigger impact on you than anything else, right? At the same time, we're acknowledging these events are actually real things. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some things that we could do if we really wanted to stop. This is you're going to laugh at this. If we wanted to cut down on school shootings, quit covering school shootings in the media and the news. There was a movement that was called Don't Name Them. Don't name the shooters. Don't discuss the shooters. Yeah. Don't do interview with the shooters' family members. If we really, truly were serious about preventing school shootings in something we had control over, we would quit talking about them at a high level. More and more, it's very clear that these school shootings are not driven by mental illness. They're not driven by bullying. They're driven by a sense of, I feel hopeless, helpless, lost in the world, and I'm going to make a name for myself doing this tremendously horrible thing.
And then how, like, you know, obviously I'm a member of the media, balancing all of what you just said, but then also the communities that we serve asking for that type of information, wanting to know more about the why behind a shooter or mm-hmm. how did the shooter get access to the weapon. Like, those are all really good questions that as a journalist, we are here meant to answer them. So in that way, how do you think we should balance?
Yeah, there's as when I have this conversation with folks in the media, it's a really big challenge because in fact, you're giving folks what they want, right?
Right.
I'm not sure that we've had any major legislative breakthroughs because of all the coverage over the gun violence, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure we're serving any purpose with that. So I think the media has a really difficult challenge. It's not easy to balance these two things. Providing accurate coverage on the impact of this is one thing. No one's gaining anything by naming the shooter or doing deep dives in their lives. We're not going to prevent anything by that, and it may lead to more shootings.
And even on the topic of like bringing up so much stuff constantly over and over and over in media, another thing that I know you feel strongly about, because I've heard you talk about it in the past, is how people talk about mental health, mental illness, and wellness on social media.
Yes.
When, like, I have younger nieces and nephews, and when I even hear them talk about mental health, they have way more words to even describe what they're feeling. And when I ask them, where are you getting this? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, TikTok, Instagram. I learned so much about PTSD or any other host of different conditions, disorders, experiences from social media. What are your thoughts about how it gets discussed online?
Yeah, I have very strong thoughts about this. If you're getting your information about mental illness from TikTok or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, and it is not a licensed, educated professional doing a very serious conversation about what these things look like, please stop doing it. In fact, there is so much utter garbage on TikTok and Facebook and Instagram about mental illness that we have kids diagnosing themselves with mental illnesses that they absolutely do not have. Hmm. So I like to clarify some things because there have been some improvements culturally that I'm very excited about. Our young folks are much more comfortable talking about negative emotions, talking about being sad, talking about being lonely, talking about suicide thoughts, for instance. Mm-hmm. Yes, we should be having these conversations and we should be able to talk about negative emotional states. At the same time, what we're doing is we're pathologizing negative emotional states. And everybody that has a negative emotional state has a mental health disorder. And that is absolutely not true in any way, shape, or form. Mental disorders are very different than medical disorders, and we really need to talk about this. There's been this huge thing that there's no difference between a medical disorder and a mental health disorder. There are so many differences. Medical conditions are not culturally bound in the same way that mental health conditions are. Mm-hmm. Mental health conditions can be spread through social contagion. It's a very real thing. And so these things we talked about, we need to model healthy behavior. We need to normalize negative emotions, which are normal. And we need to make it really clear, please don't diagnose yourself. If you think you're have a mental illness, please get a professional opinion.
Because I think sometimes when we think or talk about how mental health is discussed in media, be it, you know, television, newspapers, whatever, or social media, that, like you said, a good thing is that younger people are more willing to discuss their hardships, what they're going through, than older generations. So what would you think, or what would you say or have been saying is the proper way or a proper way to destigmatize conversations about one's mental health, especially if they're going through it?
We do want to continue to have youth talk about their experiences, talk about their feelings, be accepting and validating towards negative emotional experiences. And here's the challenge. We have raised our children to be perfectionists. We expect them to get straight A's and to go to college and have all these amazing things happen. And we talk about this idea of, oh, self-esteem. All right, you should feel good about yourself all the time. No, actually, you shouldn't. In fact, there's many times when we feel bad about ourselves because we made bad decisions and we need to learn from those bad decisions, right? When we tell people you should feel good about yourself all the time, we create a dynamic where if anything doesn't go perfectly, the youth feels bad, right? Because I'm supposed to feel good all the time. And then instead of recognizing that maybe I engage in some behavior that I need to change, they feel bad because something you did or the school did or the work did, right? Mm-hmm. So we've created this really, really challenging dynamic where youth are externalizing all their life problems. I don't feel bad because of something I done. I feel bad because the world's horrible. Mm. Yes, sometimes the world can be horrible. But this is something I talk to youth about all the time. Internal versus external locus of control. Do you feel like internal locus of control is I have charge over my life? I can make decisions. What I do and say matters, and I take responsibility for myself. People who have an internal locus of control show better life outcomes in almost every single category. Hmm. An external locus of control is when everything is somebody else's fault. Well, I didn't get a good grade because the teacher was mean, or I didn't clean up at home because my mom was mean to me, or I don't want to learn to drive because drivers are too unsafe. So what we're doing is we're saying everything is about everybody else, and the only thing I can do is stay away from everybody else. This teaches some really unhealthy coping strategies, and it ties into what's healthy coping versus unhealthy coping, right? Things that we can do ourselves are incredibly important coping strategies. But if you're waiting for the world to be kinder, nicer, and gentler for you to be happier, you're going to wait a really long time.
For the rest of your life.
Yes.
School shootings are often discussed publicly as a political point, usually brought up in conversations around gun control. But as a mental health professional, what conversations do you want to hear more in the public in regards to school shootings and how young people's experience or seek help for their mental health?
Yeah, this is a really tough conversation, isn't it? Because anytime we talk about guns and gun rights and gun control, people can get really, really passionate about that conversation. And there's some things that I will say, and I'll be very clear about this. There is no doubt that the phenomenal access to firearms that we have in this country is a contributing factor in school shootings. The political road, which is something I think should be looked at,
right,
is a much tougher road. The other things we really should be looking at is the sense of alienation, sense of being lost, sense of the future is doom and gloom that our youth are facing, right? A sense that we have so many youth that don't feel like they belong anywhere, that they're going to have anything good in their lives, right? That are disconnected from the world around them. That sense of alienation is incredibly unhealthy, right? Mm. If you look at any one of these school shooters, you don't find a youth that was well integrated into the culture at the school, who had lots of friends. We've got a lot of people that are really lost. Now, I want to be really careful here. Mm-hmm. Being alienated and not being included and being lonely is not justification for any violent act ever at any time. So
Right. Please
don't hear that. But I also will tell you that if we had youth that felt more connected, that didn't feel as alone, that didn't feel the world was a never-ending story of pain and misery and there was no future for me, we wouldn't have as many school shootings, right? Mm. So we really need to be thoughtful about what are we doing in terms of cultural engagement? What are we doing in terms of making sure people feel like they belong? Robert Putnam is a sociologist who did an amazing book, Bowling Alone, right? Mm. About how we are spending more and more time alone, less and less time in group activities, and human beings, we're designed to be involved in lots of social activities, to be part of a group. Mm. So we really need to be finding more avenues and more connections to make sure no kid feels like they've got no hope and they're not connected to anything. These are things that we can work on.
Bart Andrews is the Chief Clinical Officer at Behavioral Health Response. Bart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. These are important conversations, and I really appreciate NPR having these important conversations. People will benefit from this.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfleet.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see Time is of the essence.
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.